Chapter 22. Dawn broke over an empty sea. The radar disclosed no vessels within 30 miles, and except for the lights of a helicopter that passed over an hour earlier, the search for the source of the brown crud went uninterrupted. Just to be on the safe side, they had run without lights the entire night. Turning south soon after their confrontation with the bogus ghost ship, they were now sailing in Bahia Punta Gorda, where the trail of increasing toxicity in the seawater had led them. So far, they had been blessed with good weather, with just the slightest hint of a breeze and low winds. The Nicaraguan coastline was only 2 miles distant. The lowlands were a faint line across the horizon, as if some giant hand had drawn it using a T-square and a pen with black ink. Mists covered the shore and drifted against the foothills and the low mountains to the west. "Most strange," said Gunn, peering through binoculars. Pitt looked up. "What?" "According to the charts of the Bay of Punta Gorda, the only habitation is a small fishing village called Barra del Rio Maiz." "So?" Gunn handed the glasses to Pitt. "Take a look and tell me what you see." Pitt focused the lenses for his eyes and scanned the shoreline. "That's no isolated fishing village. It looks like a major deep-water container port. I count 2 container ships unloading at a huge dock with cranes, and another 2 ships anchored and waiting their turn. There is also an extensive area devoted to warehouses. It's a beehive of activity, all right." "What's your take on the situation?" asked Gunn. "My only guess is equipment and supplies are being stored to build the proposed high-speed railroad between the seas." "They've been damned quiet about it," said Gunn. "I've read no reports that the project was actually funded and underway." "2 of the ships are flying the Republic of China red flag," said Pitt. "That answers the question on funding." The great bay of Punta Gorda that they were entering suddenly turned into a sea of ugly brown. Everyone's attention turned to the water. No one spoke. No one moved as the massive brown crud materialized out of the morning haze, thick as a bowl of oatmeal. They stood and watched silently as the bows plowed through water that looked as if it was suffering from a plague. Its surface painted the burnt umber on a painter's palette. The effect was of skin invaded by leprosy. Standing at the helm, chewing on an unlit cigar, Giordino slowed the engines while Dodge furiously recorded and analyzed the chemistry of the water. During the long night, Pitt had become more familiar with Renee and Dodge. She had grown up in Florida and become a master diver at an early age. Falling in love with life underwater, she had achieved her master's degree in ocean biology. A few months before coming aboard Poco Benito, she came off a divorce that left her with scars. Away from home during long projects at sea, Renee returned after a lengthy research program in the Solomon Islands to find the love of her life had moved out and was living with another woman. Men, she asserted, were no longer a priority. Pitt launched a campaign to make her laugh at every chance he could think of something funny to say. His wit fell on deaf ears when it came to Dodge. A taciturn man, somehow happily married for 30 years, he had 5 children and 4 grandchildren. He had worked for NUMA since its inception. With a PhD in chemistry, he had specialized in water pollution, working in NUMA's laboratory. But with the death of his wife a year earlier, he had volunteered for field work. He might have cracked a thin smile at Pitt's attempts at humor, but he never laughed. Around them, the new sun revealed a sea surface thick with the notorious brown crud. It had the consistency of an oil slick, only much denser, and flattened the sea. No swells rolled through it as Giordino held Poco Benito at a reduced speed of 10 knots. After avoiding the explosion outside Bluefields and the narrow escape from the pirate yacht, the uneasy tension that had been building up in the ship all night seemed to become a mist so thick they could reach out and feel it. Pitt and Renee had pulled aboard several buckets of the crud and poured it into glass containers for future analysis in the NUMA labs in Washington. They also collected dead sea life they found floating in the contamination for Renee to study. And then suddenly, Giordino shouted from the pilot house, his hand motions animated by Italian breeding. "Off the port bow! Something is happening in the water!" They all saw it then, a movement in the sea as though a giant whale was thrashing in its death throes. Everyone stood as still as a statue as Giordino turned the bow of the boat 12 degrees toward the turbulence. Pitt stepped into the pilot house and examined the readings on the depth finder. The bottom was coming up rapidly. It was almost as if they were crossing a steep slope rising from the bottom of the Grand Canyon. The naked ugliness of the crud gave the sea the look of a bubbling mud pot. "Unbelievable," muttered Dodge, as if hypnotized. "According to the depth marked on the chart around our position, we should be recording 600 feet. Pitt didn't say anything. He was standing on the bow with the binoculars pressed to his eyes. "It looks as if the sea is boiling," he said to Giordino through the open window beside the helm. "Can't be from a volcanic source. There are no steam or heat waves." "The bottom is coming up at an incredible rate," Dodge called out. "It's as though it was spewing out of a volcano, but without molten lava." The shore had drawn closer, less than 2 miles distant. The water was becoming more violent, with waves slashing in every direction. The boat was rocked violently, as if shook by a huge vibrator. The brown crud had thickened until it looked like pure, unadulterated mud. Giordino stepped to the door of the pilot house and hailed Pitt. "The water temperature has taken a jump. It returned to a normal 83 degrees in the last mile." "How do you explain that?" "No more than you can." Dodge was having trouble accepting any of it. The water temperature's sudden increase, the unmarked rise on the seabed, the incredible amount of brown crud rising from nowhere. It was just inconceivable. Pitt wasn't buying it either. Everything they'd discovered went against the known laws of the sea. Volcanoes were known to raise from the depths, but not an upheaval of mud and silt. This should have been a liquid, live environment where fish of every variety existed. Here, there were no living creatures. They might have swum or crawled across the bottom once. Now they were either dead and buried under a mountain of crud or had migrated to clear water. Nothing grew. Nothing lived. It was a world of the dead, covered over with toxic muck that seemed to have materialized from nowhere. Giordino was having a difficult time keeping the boat on an even keel. The waves were not high, no more than 5 feet, but unlike waves generated in one direction by the winds of a storm, these whipped and buffeted the boat from every point of the compass. Another 200 yards and the water went crazy with uncontrolled violence. "A mass of mad mud," Renee spoke, as if gazing at a mirage. "Pretty soon it will become an island." "Sooner than you think," Giordino yelled, hauling the throttles into reverse. "Hang on. The bottom has come up beneath us." The boat yawed, but it was too late. The bow struck the rising muck, throwing everyone forward, and stuck fast. The bow wave died away, and the propellers thrashed madly, chopping the mud into an ivory-brown froth as they tried to pull Poco Benito off the mysterious rise. With the boat imprisoned in the mud, they felt like unproductive spectators. "Cut the engines," Pitt ordered Giordino. "High tide is in another hour. Wait and try then. In the meantime, we'll carry all the heavy material and supplies to the stern of the boat." "Do you really think that by moving a few 100 pounds you can raise the bow enough to slip off the mud pile?" asked Renee doubtfully. Pitt was already hauling a large coil of rope toward the transom. "Add another 700 pounds of bodies and who knows? We just might get lucky." Though every man and one woman worked as though their lives depended on it, it took the better part of the next hour to stack luggage, food supplies, non-essential equipment, and furniture as far back on the stern deck as possible. The fishing nets and traps used to disguise the boat were thrown overboard along with the bow anchors. Pitt gazed at the hands on his doxa watch. High tide in 13 minutes, and then the moment of truth. "The moment has come sooner than you thought," said Giordino. "We have a vessel approaching from the north on radar, and she's coming fast." Pitt snatched up the binoculars and peered into the distance. "Appears to be a yacht." Gunn shaded his eyes from the eastern sun and gazed out over the brown crud. "The same one that attacked us last night?" "I didn't get a good look at her in the dark through the night glasses, but I think it's safe to say there is little doubt of it being the same vessel. Our friends have tracked us down." "No time like the present," said Giordino, "to get a head start on the posse." Pitt herded everyone to the very edge of the Poco Benito's transom. Giordino took the helm and looked astern. Making certain they all had a firm grip on the railing, Pitt nodded a signal for reverse full power. The mighty diesels reverberated as Giordino pushed the throttles as far as they could go. The boat slewed and fishtailed, but was stuck fast. The thickness of the brown crud acted as a glue, adhering to the keel of Poco Benito. Even with the crew and a ton of solid substance crammed against the transom, the forward part of the boat had raised but 2 inches, not enough to break loose. Pitt hoped for a wave to lift the bow, but no waves came. The thick brown substance laid the sea flat as a newspaper. The engines strained and the propellers dug into the muck, but nothing happened. All eyes had turned to the yacht that was approaching at high speed directly toward them. Now that he saw her clearly in the daylight, Pitt estimated her overall length at 150 feet. Unlike the standard white, the mega yacht was painted lavender, like he'd seen on the Odyssey pickup truck at the dock. A masterpiece of craftsmanship, she was the essence of ocean-going luxury. She carried a 20-foot powerboat as a tender and a 6-passenger helicopter. She was near enough for him to make out her name in gold letters, Epona. Below the name, painted across the bulkhead of the second deck, was the same Odyssey logo of a running horse. A flag flying from the communications antenna also flaunted the golden horse on a lavender background. Pitt observed 2 crewmen feverishly preparing to lower the tender while several others took up positions on the long forward deck, weapons in hand. None made any attempt at taking cover. They were lulled by the belief that a fishing boat had no bite and took no precautions. The hair on the nape of Pitt's neck rose a fraction as he spotted a pair of the men loading a rocket launcher. "She's coming straight for us," muttered Dodge uneasily. "They don't look like any pirates I ever read about," Giordino shouted from inside the pilot house over the roar of the engines. "They never captured ships from an elegant yacht. 10 will get you 20, it was stolen." "Not stolen," Pitt retorted. "It belongs to Odyssey." "Is it me, or are they everywhere?" Pitt turned and called out, "Renee!" She was sitting with her back against the transom. "What is it?" "Go down in the galley, empty whatever bottles you can find, then fill them with fuel from the tank on the generator motor." "Why not fuel from the engines?" asked Dodge. "Because gas ignites more easily than diesel fuel," Pitt explained. "After the bottles are filled, insert a cloth and twist on the top."
"Molotov cocktails?"
"Precisely." Renee no sooner disappeared below when the Epona swung in a wide arc toward them. Coming head on, she was closing fast. From the new view, Pitt could see that she had the twin hulls of a catamaran. "If we don't get off this mud pile," he said irritably, "we'll have a most exasperating complication." "Exasperating complication," Giordino shot back. "Is that the best you can do?" Then to everyone's stunned amazement, Giordino suddenly ran from the pilot house, scrambled up the ladder to the roof, stood poised for a moment like an Olympic diver, and leaped onto the stern deck below Pitt and Gunn. Call it luck, call it foresight, or fate. Giordino's weight and momentum striking the stern deck was the exact inducement it took to jar the boat loose. Sluggishly, inch by inch, the boat slowly slithered off the unyielding muck. Finally, the keel slipped free and the boat leaped astern as if yanked on a big spring. Creases of mirth crinkled the corner of Pitt's eyes. "Don't ever let me tell you to diet." Giordino flashed a broad smile. "I won't." "Now for our well-rehearsed getaway," said Pitt. "Rudy, take the helm and crouch down as far as you can go. Renee, you and Patrick lay low and take cover behind all this junk we've piled on the stern. Al and I will hide under a pile of nets." The words were barely out of Pitt's mouth when one of the crewmen of the luxury yacht fired a handheld rocket launcher. The missile soared through the port door of the pilot house and out the starboard window before impacting with the water 50 yards abeam and exploding. "Good thing I wasn't in there yet," said Gunn, trying to act as if he was on a walk in the park. "See what I mean about crouching down?" Gunn jumped in the pilot house and spun the wheel, sending the hull curling away from the muck rising from below the water. But before he could bring the boat up to speed, another rocket smashed through the side of the hull amidships and struck the starboard engine. Miraculously, it failed to explode, but it caused a fire by igniting oil spilling from the shattered engine. Almost as a reflex, Gunn immediately closed the throttle to prevent any broken lines from spraying fuel on the fire. Dodge took the initiative, dove down the hatch into the engine room, and snatched a fire extinguisher mounted on a bulkhead. Pulling the safety pin and squeezing the trigger, he smothered the flames until only a billow of black smoke spiraled through the open hatch. "Are we taking on water?" Pitt shouted from under the fishnet. "It's an ungodly mess down here, but the bilge is dry," Dodge yelled back between coughing fits. To those on board the pirate yacht, it looked as though the fishing boat was mortally hit as they watched the column of smoke billowing from inside her hull. Believing her crew dead and too injured to resist, the yacht's captain backed off on its engines, slowed the vessel, and drifted across Poco Bonito's bow. "Do we still have power, Rudy? Our port engine is dead, but the starboard is still turning over." "Then they just made a big mistake," Pitt said with a cold grin. "And what was that?" Gunn replied. "Remember the pirate ship?"
"I do indeed."
Gunn cut back on the throttle to the good engine for the sucker play, allowing the little research boat to stop dead in the water. The ploy worked. Certain that his victim was about to sink, the yacht's captain swallowed the bait and idled closer. Seconds crawled by until the yacht was almost sitting on top of them at point-blank range. Seeing no movement on board and smoke still gushing from the hull, no small arms fire was poured into the seemingly stricken vessel. Then a bearded man leaned out the window of the yacht's pilot house and with an American deep southern accent spoke through a bullhorn. "Y'all who can hear me, if y'all do not abandon your boat, it will be blasted to kindling. Do not attempt to use any communication devices. I repeat, do not open communications. We all have detection equipment on board and we'll know immediately if y'all transmit. Y'all have exactly 60 seconds to take to the water. I promise y'all safe passage to the nearest port."
"Shall we reply?" asked Gunn.
"Maybe we should do as he says," muttered Dodge. "I want to see my children and grandchildren again."
"If you trust a pirate's word," said Pitt coldly, "I've got a gold mine in Newark, New Jersey. I'll sell you cheap."
Seemingly ignoring the yacht, Pitt rose into view and climbed through the gear piled on the stern and approached the jackstaff on the transom that was flying the Nicaraguan flag. He lowered the flag, unclasped the fasteners, and removed it. Then he retrieved the bundle he'd been carrying inside his shirt. In a few moments, a silk 3x5-foot emblem was raised. "Now they know where we come from," Pitt said, as everyone stared reverently at the stars and stripes snapping defiantly in the breeze. Renee returned on deck, carrying two glass jars and a wine bottle topped with gasoline. Quickly sizing up the situation, she suddenly had a revelation.
"You're not going to ram him," she cried.
"Say when," yelled Gunn in a voice edged with anticipation and the stony face of a poker player bluffing to win a pot.
"No," Renee moaned. "That isn't a hologram. It's a solid object. Ram that and we'll fold up like Lawrence Welk's accordion."
"I'm counting on it," Pitt snapped back. "You and Patrick light the wicks and get ready to toss the cocktails as soon as we collide." There was no more hesitation. The yacht was creeping past Poco Bonito's bow, now less than 100 feet away. Giordino threw Pitt one of the M4 carbines and they began blasting away at the yacht. Giordino fired full automatic, sending a spray of 5.56mm NATO rounds into the pilot house, while Pitt aimed and accurately fired single shots at the crewman holding the rocket launcher, taking him out with his second shot. Another man leaned down to pick up the weapon, but Pitt canceled him out too. Stunned that Poco Bonito was unexpectedly fighting back, the crew of the yacht dashed for cover without returning fire. Giordino did not know it, but he had put a bullet in the shoulder of the captain, who had fallen out of sight onto the deck of the pilot house. At the same moment, the helmsman was dropped by the shower of shells, and the yacht began to lose steerage and angle away. With only one engine providing power, Poco Bonito's top speed flattened out at less than half her top speed, but she still gamely thrust her bows through the water with more than enough power to do the job. No one had to be told to sit against the bulkhead with their arms protecting their heads. Renee and Dodge shared apprehensive looks at the orange life jackets that Gunn had passed out. In the pilot house, he stood firm, hands clutched on the wheel, knuckles turning ivory. The single screw chewed the water, driving the boat straight toward the big, opulent yacht. Its crew stared back, numbed with horror and disbelief, as they realized the innocent-looking fishing boat was not throwing in the towel, but rather attacking them with the intention of ramming.
A fox in sheep's clothing. Surprise was total. No other boat or ship had offered resistance before being captured. They were also shaken by the unexpected show of the American flag. Pitt and Giordino kept up their devastating fire, sweeping the decks and clearing them of the yacht's crew as Poco Benito closed the gap. The Epona looked bigger than ever as they surged toward her hull amidships just aft of the wheelhouse. The decks had been cleared. Like scared rabbits, the crew had concealed themselves below decks rather than risk the accurate fire pouring from the oncoming boat. Poco Benito looked like the boat from hell, with exhaust fumes issuing through the engine room hatch along with smoke, blown back on a 90-degree trail astern by the wind over the bows. Gunn had served as executive officer of a missile destroyer that had rammed an Iraqi submarine in the Mediterranean during the conflict to rid the area of Saddam Hussein. But the conning tower of the sub was all that had been visible then. Now he was looking at a big, solid ship that towered over him. 10 seconds to impact.